Upcoming from Essential Tremors presents. On April 11th at Design Distillery here in Baltimore, Tim Kinsella and Jenny Pulse, with opener Attorneys General, featuring guest players Geologist from Animal Collective, Andy Giles, Michael Kentoff, and Dave Jones. Disclaimer, Attorneys General is my project. This episode is brought to you by Atomic Books. Atomic is an independent bookstore full of objects made of paper, vinyl, plastic, and various other actual materials at the edge of time. Specializing in literary comics, small press, art books, and great regional beer at 8 Bar in the back of the store. Come to 3620 Falls Road in Hamden or go to atomicbooks.com. Atomic Books, literary finds for mutated minds.
And I mean, basically, you know, there was like a snare drum on the stage with the snare released. Gigantic stage. He's in the corner with an analog oscillator, and there's a loudspeaker on the, you know, on the ceiling of this enormous orchestra stage, and pointed kind of down towards a snare drum at an angle. And he's like just going up with this sweep generator on frequency. And at some frequency, suddenly the drum just started violently beating. And at the same time, you felt this like waves go across the room.
This is Essential Tremors.
I'm Lee Gardner.
I'm Matt Byers. The idea behind this show is to have musicians and other creators talk about songs that shaped who they are. We're not looking for favorite songs, necessarily. We're also not looking for songs that they'd choose to take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. What we're looking for are songs that have significance to them. Songs that might have changed the course of their creative lives, or their lives in general. Of just intonation, broadly defined as a method of tuning that encompasses more notes than are traditionally included in standard Western tunings, modernist composer Arnold Dryblatt has expanded the scope and possibilities of music written for audiences used to more conventional tones. Far more repetitive, direct, and even aggressive than others working in similar areas, Dryblatt's work seems to descend directly from, or be drawn from the same sources as, the work of Lamont Young, Tony Conrad, and Steve Reich. His latest record, Resolve, is out now on Drag City. Dryblatt was interviewed for this episode by friend of the show and previous guest, Tim Kinsella. The first work Dryblatt chose as being formative for him was the album Sacred Guitar and Violin Music of the Modern Aztecs, by various artists and released by Smithsonian Folkways.
I was asked to propose three records that are important to me. You know, I'm 70 years old, so it's not easy to pick three records. But, you know, I went back to the early years. They could be replaced by a few others. But this particular recording on Folkways is one I've really loved. It's it's basically a recording of the peoples who, you know, are, you know, the current, or at that time, the current survivors of Aztec culture. And they're playing, it's a string band. So my own music is very much, somehow derived or influenced by and using the vibration of strings. So it's a string band, a very funky string band with handmade instruments. I mean, so it's also something that, you know, appeals to me. They're, you know, the violin and this kind of, I remember kind of a cello instrument that's, you know, from, you know, carved out of, it looks like it's carved out of a single tree trunk. And it's, you know, one might say it's roughly played, you know, when one compares it to sort of the European tradition, but, you know, it has a really rough, funky, also very high harmonic content. So that has always appealed to me. And maybe I could say, you know, I picked this record, but in my early years, there were different strains of influence, you know, minimalism. I grew up, you know, kind of going to the Fillmore East and high school and stuff. I mean, there's a lot of different influences, but I did in the early years listen to a lot of, okay, what's now called world music, but, you know, non-Western music, folk music, et cetera. And, you know, all those sounds and ways of playing and different kinds of instrumentation did, you know, very much lead to what I eventually started doing.
Well, when you refer to your early years here, like...
When in my early years?
Yeah, how young are you that you're talking about? Like, were you already, by the time you heard this, were you already thinking about making your own music or starting making your own music by then?
Okay, that's interesting to try to reconstruct. I was collecting a lot, you know, a lot of folkways records. You should also imagine, I often talk about this, that the scarcity or the rarity of recordings, you know, when I was starting out, also wanting to hear, for instance, you know, non-Western music, experimental music. There were always a few record stores you go to. There's, and, you know, even in New York, there was like one or two record stores in my childhood or early 20s. I remember Dayton Records downtown, and it'd usually be some weird guy who worked there. Could be the owner, could be just one of the people who worked there who would, like, you know, be kind of in the know. And then you get into a conversation and he'd say, usually a guy, and he'd say, like, you know, maybe you'd be interested in this also, if you like that, yeah, you know. And I think that that's true across the country. But I used to go also to the Lincoln Center, actually the Donnell Library and the Lincoln Center Library. But yeah, it's actually more the Donnell Library across from MoMA had a listening library. And so I did discover a lot of things there that I didn't have. I would say this is... let's say 70. I mean, I had been in school studying. I come from the visual arts, so I was a student of, that's a long story in itself, but I can't come out of kind of early experimental filmmaking, early video art, and through a particular story, which maybe could come up later, I came into sound. I think I was probably studying with Lamond at that time, or already in his sphere, you know, around 75, 76. So I was 22, if we bring it around 22, 23. And right. I was very open to just hearing as much as I could.
And were you, like you said, you know, you went to the Fillmore East, like, were you a fan of music? You were talking about, like, that Lounge Act show, you had this realization of, oh, people can listen to music. They don't need songs.
Like, well, actually, sound,
right.
Just, you know, physical sound. Because I had the feeling, earlier, there was more segregation in the sense that I mean, there was experimental music, and then it was a tiny group of people. People don't realize how small it was. I mean, even like when the Mud Club or like, you know, Knitting Factory was small, but if you go back to the 70s or even the late 60s, yeah, I mean, it was a very small community, you know, often concerts with like 30 or 40 people, you know. Right. And yeah, I think that, and then there were, you know, there was like, you know, rock and roll and then jazz. I mean, all these different categories. I think that, I mean, there were jazz fans. There was crossover, you know, it was like Miles Davis and periods where there was a lot of crossover. I think also the late 60s, early 70s, kind of the what I would call the hippie period, people were a little bit more open, you know, like, I don't know, Grateful Dead would play some weird jams, you know, and you know, it was this kind of spacey stuff. So that was a bit more in the direction of sound, is a little bit more open. But generally, you know, if you think of the pop rock scene, I mean, you need a song, you know, like, right. You know, look at how, you know, iPod started out. Everything is songs. So,
yeah.
And just to listen to abstract sound, I mean, okay, abstract in the sense that it's, you know, it's a sound, you know, that, you know, it was still a minority who would have the patience for that, you know, like.
Right. Well, but so you're 22, you've already been through like thinking about video art, and then you're drawn to these Folkways series. I mean, so I read on your website that the various world music traditions, you studied Balkan singing techniques, you played in a Cantonese opera, and you studied these zithers of different countries. So what was it about the Aztec collection that made you choose that over the others?
Maybe it's the formation of a band, you know, as I was trying to say, with, you know, self-made instruments, you know, it's a kind of a sound that's not so far from nodal excitation from the sound, you know. It's always hard to say, you know, influence doesn't mean that you copy it, you know, especially the danger. And believe me, I was also at Wesleyan for a period, which had a huge ethnomusicology program and a world music program. And I lived through a lot of, and, you know, with Lamont, Pandapranath and all of this, I mean, it's a whole world of like playing those musics and then, you know, not being able to come out at the other end. But it's a bit more complex than what you said. So, because in Buffalo, I didn't go into that. I first, Morton Feldman was the head of the music department. And I was very interested in music. I'd done a little bit of electronic music before I went there, even though I was going more for, you know, in a department called media studies, which still exists, probably one of the earliest media art departments in the States. And I went there to study, especially with Woody and Stane and Vasulka, early video artists who founded the Kitchen. But Buffalo at that time was a very interesting place. There's Hollis Frampton, Paul Sharris, interesting in the film department. And also, as I said, I walked into the music department and they were starting Summer in Buffalo. It was a famous program with the Creative Associates, famous for experimental music. And that immediately, you know, he told me he knew actually my family. There was some kind of, we're not related, but there was kind of a family.
Who's
Morton Feldman from the from the New York garment business. And so he said, okay, just come in. You know, he understood I was not musically trained. Mm-hmm. And he had said, oh, look, I just invited Paulino Oliveros to do a workshop. That'll be great for you. So in a certain sense, in this scene, Pauline was my first music teacher. And I always tell the story that she did a fantastic educational experiment. She spent a day with each student, a full day, and you could do whatever you wanted with her. So, and then, you know, Julius Eastman was there. I mean, he was also in a workshop that I took second semester. Before I left, John Cage came. I mean, it was a lot of activity. And So also in electronic music, Joel Chatterby, I don't know if it's a name you know, but he died recently, but early electronic music composer who kind of was very good at explaining principles of sound, like frequency and amplitude, you know, which perfectly fit in with what I was doing in video, because the Vysokas are very much into using analog signals. I mean, it was all analog in those days. Analog signals like oscillators to change the video signals. Yeah. So it was the language of analog electronics. And I was playing around with these images. I was actually ironically doing stroboscopic images, video, my early videotapes. But I got kind of frustrated. And then I went to there was a concert of Alvin Lucier. This is long before I studied with him in Buffalo. And I was really amazed. And then I understood then that actually to realize these signals, you know, with sound, you could feel it, you know, it was, you could feel it in a room. It was waves. So I was very interested in this. And from that, then I found a copy of Lamont Young's Selected Writings with an interview with Richard Castellanis. That's a very important interview where he just talks about his ensemble in the 60s and how he began it. And it was exactly that, you know, working with tuning. And tuning was something I understood only from tuning frequencies in Hertz. But suddenly I realized, okay, that's what musicians are doing. You know, they're in their ear, they're comparing frequencies. So that was my entrance into sound.
So in some early writings of yours, I got this quote. One could say that the entire history of my work in music has been derived from a single subjective experience of sound. It is this experience which has generated the musical ideas and not the other way around. Is this epiphany you're talking about, the Lucier performance?
You know, of course, it's a process. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say where the moment was, but okay, I can describe that. So the piece by Lucier was a music for snare drum and sine wave and square drum and sweep oscillators. And I mean, basically, you know, there was like a snare drum on the stage with the snare released. Gigantic stage. He's in the corner with an analog oscillator and there's a loudspeaker on the ceiling of this enormous orchestra stage and pointed kind of down towards a snare drum at an angle. And he's like just going up with this sweep generator on frequency. And at some frequency, suddenly the drum just started violently beating. And at the same time, you felt this like waves go across the room. And for me, that was definitely an epiphany, you know, that in the sense that it was clear that, you know, I was hearing and feeling the wave, you know, at the same time. And that, you know, you know, there was nobody playing the drum, you know.
Right.
So that's, you know, that's that was, you know, and that actually sound is, you know, finally, yeah, air molecules kind of. Dance.
Right. So there is a. You know, there's a complexity to your systems you developed with, like, non-tempered intonation and like a lot of the math. I've been returning to rereading it every few years, you know, since the late 90s, and I'm not sure I get it. Am I? So there's you're talking about like a very academic type of scenario, but at the same time you're pointing to this sacred music. I'm wondering, was there a element of, I don't know, you talk about mystical mathematical connections in sound. Was there a mystical spiritual element to what you thought you were, your impulse?
But I kind of have tried to steer away from that. So I, of course, when I studied with Lamont, I mean, he was working with tuning. So that was the first introduction, but don't forget, I didn't have this academic training, music training, so that I, I had to find my own way through it, and also the mathematics of it. And when I left, I didn't, you know, it was a period with Lamont, but I quickly wanted to go off on my own. That's just another story in itself. But and then I had, you know, I needed a reference. I didn't have the you know, every good boy does right. fine as a reference, as you know, I mean, I understand that now. But so, you know, because for most musicians, it's like deviating from what they've learned. But for me, it was a little bit different. So, and then I found an acoustic book. I was researching a lot at that period. I was young, and I found an acoustic book from the 50s from the UK. Some real nerdy scientist who said, you know, who was talking about tuning. It was a book about tuning, and he suggested to build a monochord. And so I did this, and he also had some experiments to do with it. And then I understood suddenly that these are proportions of a string. And I mean, or these are vibrations of a string, that with strings, you can see it, you can hear it. It's like a geometry you can hear. And that the numbers are from that, like one half of the string, one third of the string, one fourth of the string. And in fact, my tuning does not use the intervals like Harry Parch or, you know, all those other intervals which are between harmonics, which is more theoretical, not theoretical, but it's more complex. I only use harmonics that are related to a fundamental directly. So I don't even need a denominator, because it's just, if I say the 11th harmonic, it automatically means it's related to 4 or to 2, depending on what octave you're in. So simplifies it a lot. Mm-hmm. And I developed a kind of a tuning system based on this. Yeah, you know, I listened empirically, and I decided on certain tones that seemed to work together. And then I realized that those tones work in well with the actually fit the mathematics. You know, it's a very simple mathematics. I mean, we learned the multiplication tables a long time ago. So, you know, there it's not so complicated. So and then I, you know, I, like, for instance, my first tuning instrument, I found this old, I used to look for weird instruments and walk around New York to these, you know, weird music stores. And I found a little piano with an iron frame, tiny, and I retuned it. And I first thing I did, I retuned it to the first 23 odd harmonics, because even harmonics are always octaves, right? And then I saw, when I put my, and I wrote the little numbers on the keys, and it was pretty crazy. And then I saw, oh, if I play 1-5-3 or 1-5-3-15, it made certain sonorities, certain chords. And I built up my system according to that. And then I retuned it, because I, you know, I understood, like, every time you go up one, you get too many tones. So I stopped at 11. I could have, the next would have been 13. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, basically all these years I've been composing with this tuning. And when new musicians play with me, you know, these days a lot of young people know a lot about tuning, but that was not the case earlier. You know, in my bands or musicians, they would look at me like I was out of my mind. And then I would kind of teach them this, and then they would learn to play it and to hear it. And it's, you know, so you'd hear, like, you know, you'd know where 15, you know, depending on the instrument, like some instruments it's easier than others. So at this point, it's not like I'm trying to be complicated. That is the tuning. That's what I've used since the late 70s. I hope that wasn't too complex. So I tried, and it comes observing a string. Yeah.
The big difference would be, like, in terms of, like, you know, this is, the title of this album is Sacred Music. You know, it's part of, you know, practitioners of a long tradition, and you're doing exactly the opposite, like, you know, deviating from a common tradition that you came from. I'm wondering.
Well, that's not totally true. Yeah. Yes and no. I mean, what I did find out is that there's a whole tradition going back to, you know, classical Greece, basically two civilizations, yeah. So, a large, you know, or at least that are related to, so Chinese and Greek civilization, coming also in the early Middle Ages, where the monochord is like the most important instrument because it's the reference for everything else. And so this knowledge was there. And so there is a tradition, actually. And so that was interesting for me to discover. And it actually continued. Like in China, they have these, there are certain instruments, the zither family, that's what interested me in the zither family, that there are certain instruments that that come from the monochord. So yeah, I mean, and you know, it's interesting, you're kind of harping a little bit on this term, or, you know, sacred or spiritual. I think we all have there's a spiritual mode. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, but I'm not trying to define it. Like, you know, of course there's moments where, especially in concert, especially with ensemble, you know, you hear like this kind of overtones filling a room and, you know, with these tones coming together, and also the tuning, it can bring up certain emotions, you know, which one could call spiritual or whatever. But I made a choice early on not to clothe it, the whole thing in that terminology, and let the public, you know, say what they want. I remember So years ago, I think I was playing in Budapest. This is in the communist time, and I lived in Budapest a bit, and I had the ensemble played. And afterwards, I met three different people. There was a guy from Georgia, Soviet Georgia, and there was a Chinese visiting. I don't remember what the third one was, but from somewhere else. I think he was from Bulgaria. And they all said, oh, it sounds a lot like, you know, Chinese or Georgian folk music or Bulgarian, you know. So they read into it that. Yeah. So which I like that very much, you know, that it. Yeah. It speaks to a tradition, but it's not really doing that. But there's something in it which maybe speaks to all these traditions, kind of an Ur music. Yeah.
You're talking about, you know, you're setting the scene for where you started out as a very small community of experimental musicians. You have a hunch that you want to tap into a more sort of, for lack of a better word, primitive or modes. And the other sort of countercultural trends I'm aware of at that time that were similar would be Jerome Rothenberg's anthologies. And then a little later, even like the research books in like the early 80s and that like modern primitive sort of scene. So I was curious about if you were interested and motivated by those things.
Okay, it's interesting to hear his name mentioned, because I was tuned in since a very early age, even from high school, into the kind of American poetry scene, you know, first the Beats, and then I did have the certainly Technicians of the Sacred. I was following the, you know, Ethnopoetics and his writings, but I don't really make a connection to this. To my music. And I also I have a problem with the term primitive. Yeah. Because, you know, finally, first of all, as I mentioned earlier, there's a connection to in this tradition. If we look for a tradition, a tradition that runs through both, you know, classical musics in non-Western traditions or in early European traditions, and also to folk music. So, in both, in this, you know, taking the reference of the monochord, for instance, for tuning and for observing different relations of tuning. So, you know, maybe also another strand or way to look at them, we say, you know, primitive, or like, you know, let's go to minimalism, or kind of, you know, I was an autodidact, yeah. So, in the sense that I wasn't coming from a conservatory training, and it probably had a lot. But I had also heard a lot of, you know, rock music from different periods. So that when I began to develop my music in the very beginning, it literally came from striking a string, and so my signature bass, which I'm still performing so until now. Or which is not really a bass. It's a, you know, a bass like instrument with a, which I use only because it has a long speaking length. I started beating the strings or hitting the strings in such a way to kind of generate or coax out the overtone structure. And so you know, you can say in different ways. I don't know, you know, it's primitive in the sense that, or let's say it's reduced. Yeah, mm-hmm. is a better term, or it's like a reduction, or it's kind of a, you know, a very basic impulse. And the early music, you know, if it's a good look at nodal excitation, comes from that. Yeah, mm-hmm. from that kind of, and the percussion also comes through that, exciting the string. You know, this term exciting string, it's in a physics term from mm-hmm. acoustics books. Yeah, so which I co-opted, and it has, of course, this interesting double meaning. And and even coming to the current record, there's, you know, it's it in a certain sense, this record very much harps back to that initial impulse. Yeah, it's a mm-hmm. you know, in simplifying and reducing so, you know, I and yeah, my interest in different ethnic musics, I mean, it's hard to say that there's one of these things, one of these areas is the thing that really moved me. It's a combination, you know, right, right. On one hand, listening to different non-Western music, doing this research, you know, listening to a lot of different music. I mean, the 60s, late 60s, early 70s was, you know, there was a lot happening also in jazz and improvised music. You know, as I said, I grew up, you know, listening to rock music and, you know, being part of that kind of cultural explosion in the 60s. Mm. And so it's hard to say that there's one thing, you know, I think there's a lot of things that, you know, brought me into that. And certainly, like, then the personalities, you know, like early minimalism, if I use Tony Conrad's phrase, you know, Lamont, Alvin Lucier, two very different figures, both, you know, somehow in from very different aspects, looking at the acoustics of sound, and yeah, also tuning or the experience of sound. And then later Phil Niblock was a very good friend, and also you know, I used to hang around his loft for years and years, and we're still close, and many others, you know. So, you know, and I heard a lot of music, you know. Yeah, so you know, which of those musics, how they kind of, you know, created the soup that I swam in, you know, right. It's hard to say.
The second work Dryblatt chose as essential to forming his sensibilities was Outside the Dream Syndicate by Tony Conrad with Faust.
Well, okay, there's a story there that's also kind of an origin story, because Tony taught in Buffalo, but when I was there, he was still teaching in Antioch. Because of the interesting experimental film, he came quite often to Buffalo. And I remember one time that he came, he gave a lecture about tuning, which nobody understood, because it was like all these filmmakers and video artists. It was actually at the Vasulka's Loft in downtown Buffalo. But I remember it very much impressed me. I have a tape of it, actually. And so I think, and so that was the first time I met him. Then, of course, when I was in Lamont's loft, Tony used to come by sometimes when he was in New York, and also through kind of the downtown scene. You know, he was then was teaching in Buffalo. He then moved to Buffalo, was teaching in Buffalo. His films were shown downtown, and I remember a concert at the Kitchen also. Very early. I think that's probably, what is it, on the Infinite Plane or whatever. There's this, there's a recent recordings that came out. And also in reference to Lamont, because I was already having doubts about some of the program, and I was Lamont's tape archivist, and then that leads also to the famous article in The Wire, where I had discovered that, you know, actually Lamont's music was sustained tones from the very beginning, but that this whole numerical tuning system came in when Tony came in. So he had already been working on that. And so that there was a whole conflict there. And I also, okay, this is a moving forward, then table the elements. I copied some recordings because Lamont didn't want anything that Tony and John Cale were on to be released, because it was then a threat to his authority. So I did that for myself. But then when I met Jim and actually when I was out there at that time, when we might have met ourselves, I started, you know, they had never met anyone then, you know, when I first came, except for Tony. And I started talking about all of this, and I played them this, I think the second visit, I played them some of the tapes. So, and then over the years, of course, you know, we would meet. Yeah. I mean, and had some discussions. We're often in concerts together. Then there's a ton of concerts and various, it was a Table of the Elements tour and so forth. So it goes way back. But coming to the question, I'm sorry.
No.
There's to try to answer you, as I was discovering the situation at Lamont's and the music that everyone was telling me blew their minds in New York, because of course I was a younger generation. The older generation were my peers. You know, they're all dying now, but those who heard the Theater of Eternal Music in the 60s, who said, wow, it was, it was a time when music could still blow people's minds. I'm not sure if that can anymore, but you couldn't hear it, this music. I mean, there was just this one recording I had made. I saw all the, you know, as I was working with the tapes, I thought there were hundreds of tapes, and I understood it was very important. And I was visiting a friend of mine, Ernie Gusella, who's not so well known, but is a video artist in New York. And he said he knew that he knew Tony also. He was also had visited in Buffalo, and he played me this record, you know. And when I heard it, I couldn't believe it. I said, that's it. That's the sound. Yeah.
That people had been describing, but
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Heard.
I mean, obviously it's not Lamont singing, because it's not the most beautiful voice to listen to. And, Lamont is more the concept, but it was also the strings, like Tony's violin, which we know, and John Cale playing a flattened bridge and that drone string sound. And that's what we hear on Day of Niagara. And then I heard it so clearly on this record, I thought, wow.
Are you talking this, when you say this record, you mean Tony with Faust?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that had been, I don't know. When was that originally released? I mean, Table of the Elements must have been.
No. Much earlier. This is.
No, that's what I'm saying. But I only know the reissue, you know, I was.
Right. So I'm sorry, it's a bit embarrassing.
I don't need this. It existed already as an album when you're like.
It was an LP. It was an LP, 72, and this moment was probably around 76. Yeah, I assume that's where I put it.
Sure.
I didn't know about the record. You know, it was in Europe. Very few people had it. He played it for me, and that, you know, got me thinking, like, okay, you know. And then of course it was just a matter of time. It took some years for Tony to, he was, you know, involved in other things. He wasn't playing music, but he kept wanting to get copies of those tapes. You know, as you get older, you sort of want some of the archival material, you know. What were we doing back then? And Lamont didn't want to give it to him. And I think at some point, because he was quite loyal to Lamont for many years, I tried, you know, I talked to him about all these issues. He was very loyal until one time, you know, one moment, he was no longer.
And through this controversy, like, you had met him, you were aware, you saw his lecture, you knew the record, but you didn't have a friendship to them.
We had met in Buffalo, you know, he knew me as one of those. He knew that I was, you know, it's really hard to say, you know, we, there was a also a Buffalo community in New York, you know, of people who had been there. He was teaching there. We knew a lot of people in common. You know, I was very close with the Vizulkas all the years. And I remember being with him downtown in the Fine Arts Building with, like, here's a name. I don't know if you've ever heard. David Hikes was a student of, Tony's, who made, who actually did get more into this spiritual side. He was doing the, you know, like kind of the, Mongolian overtone singing, and had a kind of career in the 70s. I remember being at a party with the two of them, must have been 77, 78 around that time. You know, and I talked to Tony about that record. But this aspect of what, you know, I was discovering only really clicked when he started performing music himself. And then I remember and it took a long time. So to the 80s, I mean, then...
when did he start performing music again?
I can't give you a date, but all I can say is at Ars Electronica in Linz, we met a lot of the Buffalo people were there in 91 or 2. And that was the first time he played violin with a tape. And he said, could you just go on the board just because I need somebody to to mix? It was the first time I heard it. And, you know, I would date it late 80s.
So you already had made Nodal Excitations. You were on your path already. And then, and this was... what, a feeling of something, like, what struck you that, you know, you're named, asked to name three records of all the records ever. What is it? I was struck that you referred to the sacred music of the Aztecs as, like, funky a couple times, which is, you know, like, not a standard we hear much.
These days, yeah.
Yeah, or certainly in these contexts.
It dates me. Dates me maybe to a certain time, but...
Man, I mean, true funkiness is, you know, irrepressible,
ragged, like, ragged. So I can tell you this, that in fact, when, you know, in the early days, some people, like, you know, they would try to describe my sound, people who were not in music, and they would call it, like, things like ragged, kind of funky, rough sound, you know, they wiry kind of thing. And it, you know, that record has that. But with you know, with Tony, I mean, Tony's violin playing, you know, kind of also works. And I never actually played him that record or talked to him about it. But I chose Tony's record because of this. It was a kind of confluence of different strands, you know, our connection through Buffalo, through Lamont, hearing this record and realizing, it was a confirmation for me of what I was surmising, you know, how important the string aspect was to that band. And also what I didn't say to, I mean, I mentioned in passing earlier that my earliest videotapes were that I made in Buffalo before I went into sound were stroboscopic kind of color field things, which I made even before I saw the Flicker. I'm not even sure. I mean, there's Paul Sharitz also who did actually color Flicker fields, but you know, that was also a weird kind of a younger generation doing that in video. You know, I'm not sure if it's the earliest, but might be. You know, it's rarely been shown. I only showed those in Italy once. So there's a number of things. I think in music, you know, and then of course, then as we continue, then there's the other aspect that because we go back to Lounge Acts, that Jim rediscovered me on the heels of Tony. You know, first he discovers Tony and you know, through Table of the Elements and that association, and then Tony's recordings get released, and you know, and Jim is a kind of a publicist for that and contextualizing that. And then he discovered me, you know? Mm-hmm. So, definitely, you know, a kind of generations. Yeah. So.
Right. Well, I'm curious. I mean, it's kind of maybe a weird question to ask, like a little outside of this, but like, what about Tony and not like Henry Flint, for example? Like, that is a similar, it's strings. I'm not asking you to like diss Henry Flint or something, but it's strings. It's more immediately folky, or in a, I mean, folky is a weird word, but you know, like, yeah, what is the difference in your mind, like, that Tony's doing? Because that's who I can think of that would be the most
similar. I mean, I have nothing. I mean, Flint is a very important and kind of bizarre character.
Well, there's a zillion people you didn't name, so it's a little weird to be like,
but
why
I was
didn't
asked
you name
for
this
three.
One guy?
I was right, asked right. for three. And, right. and, like, as I said, there could have been many others, you know. It was not an easy choice. You know, I could have, but maybe also I was thinking of like origins. Yeah.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, always those things, pick three records, you know, pick right, three right. people that, you know, influence you.
So the choice of Tony over Flint is not like,
it's biographical
of,
also.
Right.
Not only the sound, it's you know, right, what right. he's doing, it's also biographical
right.
connections. Yeah, I should say that. I mean, I've met Flint a handful of times and I followed him, you know, of course, I like, you know, and there, of course, is a, you know, is a early, there's a biographical element between the two of them. Mm-hmm. But let's say this, I mean, Tony has had a much larger influence on the music world. So, certainly.
What about Tony with Faust versus any other aspect of, or any other example of what Tony might have done? Like, what is it about that one?
That shouldn't be a misunderstanding. You know, Faust had nothing to do with it. So I was just hearing his playing for the first time without Lamont and understanding the contribution. But I mean, in fact, then Tony got the because that was kind of a weird one-off that happened in Europe with Tony, you know.
Right.
Whereas then when Tony had the opportunity, then he started developing it for ensembles and over the years. And it was not the aspect of it being with Faust was not what interested me. Made that interesting to me.
Beyond Video is a volunteer-run video library in Baltimore. Basically, an old-school video rental store reimagined with a 21st-century nonprofit twist. Beyond offers nearly 30,000 titles from every region, era, and genre of cinema on DVD, Blu-ray, and VHS, a collection created by crowdsourcing disc donations from movie lovers like you. With no rental fees or late fees, members get unlimited rentals from their collection for a small monthly donation. Find out more about joining or donating at beyondvideo.org. Or when in Baltimore, visit Beyond at 2545 North Howard Street. And for a limited time, new members who mention Essential Tremors when signing up will get an extra month for free. What do Tony Conrad, Rhys Chatham, Captain Beefheart, and Faust have in common? Each have legendary recordings on the table of the Elements record label. Long out of print, these and other records from the label are available again with the Table of the Elements Discovery Box, available only at withinthings.com. Within Things Curiosity Shop has partnered with the label to help continue their legacy of connecting sound with listeners since 1993. Visit withinthings.com and search Table of the Elements to learn more. final piece of music Dryblatt chose as being crucial to him was Robert Ashley's Automatic Writing.
She was a visitor. 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 She was a visitor.
I'm excited to hear what you have to say about this because same as I've been following your music for 25-ish years, I have tried to access automatic writing, and I think I, you know, every few years I circle back and I have a friend, you know, telling me how amazing it is, and sometimes I'm like, yeah, I know what's happening, and a lot of the time, re-listening to it now for this conversation, I'm just like, I don't know. I don't get what people are...
Right. It wasn't until many years later that I began to become more interested in his music. But it had a lot to do with a part of my work, which most people in the music scene don't know, because I'm also a visual artist. I do installations, and I work very much with text. I mean, that's developed in Europe very much. So I have a whole other career and persona. Which is an issue in itself that many people in the music world don't know about that, and the people in the art world don't know about my music. But it's also text oriented, and you know, I have done some. I did a recent installation which has a sound component, which is coming out hopefully by the end of the year or early next year. It's a work called Music of from the Resting State, from an installation of mine called The Resting State. It is hopefully going to be also a version of just of music and LP, and then a box with some of the other materials from the installation, where I worked with kind of subliminal text or spoken text. In that case, the resting state is kind of the state when we were kind of we're waiting when the brain has not much input and you're just kind of like, you know, what thoughts are coming up about the future and the past. And I, you know, that record, again, I could have chosen many other records, you know, it was instinctively, I just kind of, I think it also because it relates to my kind of other strands of my work. At the same time, it's of course incredibly, it is minimal in a very different sense to what we normally call minimal music. And it doesn't really go anywhere. It's, you know, for lack of a better term, meditative. And there's this kind of text, which, you know, we kind of just kind of goes in and out of us, kind of, as I use the term subliminal utterance of text that kind of works on the unconscious. Yeah, so, and Paul de Marinis also worked on that, who's someone that I knew at Wesleyan and still am in touch with, and whose work I like very much. Also, on the border of sound and visual arts. It's just a record that I like, yeah.
It makes perfect sense that this is on your mind, right? Because its whole foundation is that it's involuntary speech, right? And that, like, a structural logic will emerge whether one imposes it on it or not. So it makes sense in terms of your new installation. Is this installation the first time that you're consciously trying to synthesize your music and your text art practice?
Well, it's interesting. I've kept it kind of separate, although that work began in theater, some large theater pieces in the early 90s, and where in some cases the orchestra performed. And then they kind of, I made a conscious decision to kind of separate them because it was kind of confusing people. And so I, you know, they were kind of separate practices.
What did that look like, separate? Do you regret those decisions now to separate them?
No. I think it was necessary at the time. It wasn't a wall between them, but I, at least I took out the aspect of having live music with these installations in a theater context. I started to work more in the visual arts situation. And I've always had, some questions about sound just being an accompaniment. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I was teaching media art for many, many years. I just retired, and I would also always talk to my students about that, you know, just that, you know, the visual, you know, is often the, you know, the number one element, and then you just kind of put some sound with it, and to be conscious of that, that the sound, that there's a reason that there's an audio aspect, and to take it seriously.
She was a visitor. 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 She was a visitor.
This has been Essential Tremors. Essential Tremors is produced by me, Matt Byers, and Lee Gardner. Essential Tremors is distributed by WYPR Baltimore. For more information about Essential Tremors, go to essentialpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.
She was a visitor. 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 She was a visitor.